This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Vice President Kamala Harris meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference as he requests more U.S. aid for his country. Both have been reacting to the event's big news, the death of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny. The Vladimir Putin critic died Friday in a penal colony. Zelensky put the blame on Vladimir Putin.
Putin does not value lives of people. He does not understand and does not respect any rules. The only thing that is important for Putin is money and power.
Allies of Navalny say he was murdered. They're demanding his body be released. President Biden visited East Palestine, Ohio on Friday, and he vowed to continue the cleanup process 1 year since a train derailment and chemical spill. And a judge in New York ordered former President Trump to pay over $355 million in a civil fraud lawsuit. It found he misrepresented his wealth to get better loan terms. This is ABC News. Authorities in Virginia are investigating a deadly home explosion near Washington, D.C.
One firefighter is dead and nine others injured when a home exploded in Sterling, Virginia, Friday, sending debris into the street.
Total devastation. There's a debris field well into the street and into the neighboring home.
Loudoun County Assistant Fire Chief James Williams says crews were called to investigate a gas leak.
Soon after arrival with firefighters inside, the house did explode.
Local authorities and the ATF investigating. Mark Remillard, ABC News.
Federal authorities say the second critically endangered North Atlantic right whale has been found dead over the last month and that it showed injuries consistent with colliding with a ship. The whale was found floating off Savannah, Georgia. There are fewer than 360 of those whales left in the world. Unusual golf mishap for star Jordan Spieth. He was disqualified from the Genesis Invitational because he signed the incorrect scorecard. Brian Clark, ABC News.
Give the star in your life the brightest gift in the world. Name a star after them. This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. For $59 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit starregistry.com, you can name a star for birthdays, weddings, or even memorials. Over 45 years, we have named millions of stars for celebrities and individuals from around the world. The star you name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Visit starregistry.com or call 800-282-3333.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of La Crosse. Eagle 1490 AM WLCX and on the Civic Media app. Up North News Radio with Pat Kreitlow. Wisconsin's home for daily conversations about the state's latest headlines and stories. Weekday mornings from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Governor Evers is considering new legislative district maps that experts say are an improvement over the current gerrymandered maps. As Mike Mohn reports, fair maps should lead to more functional and responsive state government.
This week, the Republican-led legislature approved the map submitted by Democratic Governor Tony Evers. Yuseli Flores with the Wisconsin Fair Maps Coalition says if these maps are fully implemented, they'll finally usher in a more balanced legislative body.
These maps would change Wisconsin's future for years to come, and it will definitely get rid of what happened in 2011. It'll dismantle that partisan gerrymander.
Following the 2010 census, Republicans were in charge of the redistricting process and have since maintained large majorities in the legislature. That's despite more competitive races for statewide elections. Evers has pledged to sign the maps. However, some of his fellow Democrats have misgivings about the GOP's approach, including language that says the maps wouldn't take effect until the general election in November, excluding any special or recall elections this year. And some policy analysts say Republicans still might hold a slight advantage even with the Evers maps. However, Flores says that doesn't mean there won't be any progress in establishing the change advocates want to see. She adds this could help bolster candidate recruitment in marginalized districts.
Folks that might not have millions of dollars in the bank that are running because they're tired of big money politics.
State election leaders have set a deadline of March 15th for the new maps to be in place. The hurry to update the boundaries comes after the Wisconsin Supreme Court overturned the current legislative districts in a December ruling. The court would have to choose maps if an agreement isn't finalized in time. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
Your news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Quite windy today. Winds will gust over 30 miles per hour, maybe 35 out of the west. Even though we'll have sunshine and air temps near 32, wind chills will be near zero or below most of the day. For tonight, mostly clear and breezy and a low around 25. Currently 17 degrees.
News talk for Homan, on Alaska, and of course, La Crosse. Eagle 1490 WLCX, the talk of La Crosse, 0.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM. This is The Shaw, WAUK, 0.1 FM. Broadcasting to Southeast Wisconsin at 540 AM.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, I'm your host for this, our second hour of our discussion this morning of law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Thank you for once again joining me for this all-important discussion or exposition of these major issues, these major events of just these past several days. As always on our Saturday morning broadcast, inviting your contributions, your perspectives, especially your questions and your inquiries about everything from procedure to law to facts. We'll try to address those. And that number, of course, to call in to the broadcast stations here of Civic Media at 844-967-2789. One more time, that's 844-967-2789. Always delighted to take your questions, your comments. Right before the break, we were talking with Mark, who is on the line still with me, talking about the interrelationship of all of these things, one of the themes of this morning's discussion. The fraud that permeates many of, if not all of these cases, civil and criminal both. And Mark, you were making that point right before the break here at the top of the hour. Why don't you go ahead and tell me more about your perspective or your question or comment about what we see recently in connection with the Trump enterprises and the Trump behaviors?
Yeah, the behavior just extends to foreign policy now and national security policy in terms of the border, because Trump says he doesn't want to see it happen. And so it's not happening as far as aid going to Ukraine, as far as, you know, fixing our border policy. That it's amazing that a man that has been adjudicated to be a liar generates such fear among some of those in the political class that they're willing to just kowtow to this man who has no official power anymore. But his unofficial power is just it's kind of scary, because that he just gives his marching orders and people are willing to die for Donald Trump. I mean, that they're the guy who just was found to be, you know, arrested by the FBI for lying before the FBI and lying before Congress in terms for Hunter Biden. I mean, that gets drawn into this web as well, because that these people are inspired by a man who has been a known fraudster for decades. I mean, this guy, we knew he was a, you know, kind of a charlatan from years ago, but, you know, he was elected president, but now the power he has is frankly rather terrifying. If you dig down and look at it, what he could, I don't know, I'm getting a little, you know, flabbergasted.
Legitimately so, right? Flabbergasted, as we all are by this. And again, we use the word unprecedented a lot these days, Mark, but it really does apply. We've never had a situation like this where a former president has been involved in this much litigation post-presidency, even in the course of his presidency itself, not only in terms of criminal cases, but civil cases. An unprecedented comment, not only upon who he is, how he operates, but the other aspect of this that I think is implicit, Mark, in your comments this morning, wisely articulated and much appreciated here, is just this, that Donald Trump, as he did in the wake of the Judge Engoron judgment yesterday, identify the judges being corrupt, the attorney general also corrupt. All of the processes in all of these cases are, according to Donald Trump, accomplished by virtue of a deprivation of his due process rights. The judges are acting badly. The witnesses are not properly presenting the facts. The prosecutor is certainly at the top of the list. People who are out to get him are anti-Trump, as he often says. And, you know, if it may well be that if one of these cases was the only one we're talking about, we might indeed look at that. We'd probably dismiss that, too, after some examination of it. But now we have all of these. And at some point, this notion that everyone out there in all of our judicial proceedings, in all of our courtrooms, state courtrooms, federal courtrooms, judges across the board of derivations on all sides of the aisle, if you will, all of them, according to Donald Trump, involved in this massive conspiracy, if you will, to go after him when, in fact, he has done nothing right. It is a difficult position to maintain. It is quite literally, as you're indicating, Mark, incredible to maintain that there is nothing here, even if along the way you identify particular aspects of some of these cases, which may or may not be proven, all of them together do, in fact, establish this practice of fraud, some of its civil in nature, as we have seen, and likely going to be proven in court, some of this criminal in nature as well. We hasten to add, as we always do on this broadcast, that any criminal defendant, like Donald Trump, in the wake of grand jury indictments, both in the state system and the federal system, presumed innocent. And it is only after a jury, or in some cases, a judge, if a jury is waived, only after that jury makes a determination beyond a reasonable doubt, that's the standard in criminal cases, only if a jury makes that determination beyond a reasonable doubt, does so unanimously, that presumption of innocence goes away. And that happens the moment a judgment of conviction, a judgment of guilt is returned by a verdict from a jury. And of course, appellate rights also follow that, as Donald Trump affirms all the time in these civil cases when he indicates, as he has the right to do, is going to appeal these cases to the next highest court. All of this, Mark, to your good point about the thread that we see not only presently, but in the past, presumably in the future, as we talk about all of these cases. You mentioned as well, Mark, this interesting case involving an ex-FBI informant. And indeed, it also is a part of a larger pattern about lying and misrepresenting. The story there, of course, is that a special counsel was investigating Hunter Biden, who's the son of the president, as we well know. The very same special counsel investigating Hunter Biden, also pursuing prosecutions on gun cases and on tax charges, has now charged this former FBI informant with fabricating claims. The FBI informant making up claims that President Biden and Hunter had each sought about $5 million in bribes from a Ukrainian company. And that's the statement made by this informant to the FBI, proven to be completely wrong. This longtime FBI informant, his name is Alexander Smirnov, S-M-I-R-N-O-V, is accused of falsely telling the FBI that Hunter Biden, again, the son of the president, paid a board member of this energy giant named Burisma. You've heard a lot about them in the news, and also demanded money to protect that company, from an investigation by the country's prosecutor general in Ukraine at that particular time. The story again, advanced by this Alexander Smirnov, seemed to back up some completely unsubstantiated claims in the Congress, advanced by the Republicans in the Congress, of a Biden crime family. And that is the basis upon which some of the movements forward in committee to try to impeach the present president, based upon this notion of criminality, things he has done wrong with his son and perhaps others as well. Well, it turns out now that based upon this latest disclosure and the indictment of this Alexander Smirnov, that those statements by him about the criminality of Hunter Biden with his father, they turn out to be completely unsubstantiated, completely false. They're simply lies. And the 37-page indictment, which, again, I commend your reading of, it was unsealed late Thursday in a California court. again, brought by the special counsel. His name is David Weiss. He's the same special counsel who's prosecuting Hunter Biden, now is charging this FBI informant for lying to the FBI, perpetuating this notion that the present president, his name, of course, Joe Biden, and his son was somehow involved in criminal activity. It appears as well from the indictment that the motivation for Smirnoff doing this, for lying to prosecutors, for advancing this complete lie, seems to have been political in nature. During the 2020 campaign, Smirnoff apparently sent to the FBI a series of messages expressing bias, that according to the indictment here, against Joseph Biden, including some texts. And they were, of course, replete with some typos and misspellings, as they often are, but boasting along the way that he had information that could put Joe Biden, but also his son, Hunter Biden, in jail. And in the wake of that initial information, Republicans in Congress attempted to get more information about this. Along the way, Chuck Grassley from Iowa released a copy of an FBI record that included this false allegation without naming Smirnoff at the time, and again, without indicating that the FBI already was suspect about whether or not any of this information was true and accurate. At the time, Chuck Grassley, Senator Grassley, described claims as very significant allegations from a trusted FBI informant implicating then Vice President Biden in a criminal bribery scheme. Again, all of that disclosed just this past week to be completely untrue. The course of this, again, as always, will go forward. The problems in the case, again, the underlying problems with the statements made by Smirnoff are many. The FBI officials along the way plainly did not seem to think much of Smirnoff's allegations from the start. 2020, they concluded his claims did not merit any continued investigation, and actually told Trump administration officials in the Justice Department of that decision. And all this, again, coming out in the wake of this indictment of just this past week by a grand jury in California. The course of this, again, indicates not only the work of the special counsel there, but also the focus on the need to ensure that the information that's provided, of course, to the FBI is accurate. When it is not, that can indeed form the basis for an indictment against an individual. This matter, of course, again, the Smirnoff himself presumed innocent until proven guilty. Along the way, of course, Hunter Biden still facing charges, as we know, as we've talked on this broadcast, about gun charges and tax charges, those gun charges pending in Delaware, tax charges in California. His lawyers, Biden's lawyers, saying that the indictment of Smirnoff is proof that he was the target of this politically motivated smear campaign. We will see as this case proceeds through the courts, but exactly the kind of thing that Mark was describing in his comments to us of just a few moments ago. When we come back, we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about this major RICO prosecution still proceeding in the court in Georgia. Stay with us for that all-important discussion and the evidentiary ruling of hearings of just this past week.
Listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabe.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
Did you know there was a time when African Americans couldn't buy their own homes? In 1948, the Supreme Court ruled the ban on selling property to black buyers was unconstitutional. Yet black people still couldn't purchase homes in white neighborhoods. The Fair Housing Act in 1968 ended this type of discrimination. but there's still work to do. Today, only 40% of black populations own their own homes. Listen for another Black History Story here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
You're listening to the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM. You're listening to The Shaw, WAUK.
These major cases involving Donald Trump in the state and, yes, indeed, the federal courts as well of our land. Talking in our first hour about this major civil judgment entered against him in connection with evaluations charges brought by the attorney general in the state of New York. This major case, the implications of that for the future of the Trump company and also the Trump players, the Trump family members themselves. Talking as well about the significance of the scheduling just this past week by Juan Marchant, who is another New York judge presiding over the criminal hush money case that also pending in Manhattan. That going ahead on March 25th, going to take weeks to try, alleging that Donald Trump was responsible for hush payments made to women to keep them quiet, this catch-and-kill approach that has been the subject of a lot of reporting in the past. Now apparently finally coming to trial, the first of these several criminal cases actually going to trial. Among those cases, of course, is the D.C. insurrection, the interference with the election case. That case, again, suspended right now while the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court itself is determining whether to take the issue of immunity before it. We'll see what happens there. The other case, of course, is the Mar-a-Lago case. That's the other federal case pending in Florida. No clear statement of when that case may go to trial, but there are proposals certainly for that to happen later in this year. A lot of activity going on there right now with related to the witnesses and some concerns that Jack Smith, as the chief prosecutor, as the special counsel, has about the disclosure of witness statements and witness information when witnesses these days are being threatened by people who identify them as appropriately being witnesses in a trial, and the concern about ensuring the integrity of the process, ensuring the safety and security of those witnesses, if in fact disclosures about who they are, where they live, what they do are made public. We know we live most regrettably, most unfortunately, illegally in a time when people threaten to do these kinds of things against witnesses. It is a concern for prosecutors to ensure the integrity of the cases as they go ahead. The other case we're going to spend a lot of time talking about this morning, pulling apart in the wake of a two-day evidentiary hearing, is this major RICO state prosecution charging 19 individuals, including Donald Trump, many others. Four of them have already pled guilty, four of them pleading guilty in front of the state court judge there in Fulton County, Georgia. The other defendants going ahead, and one of them, whose name is Michael Roman, bringing a motion to disqualify the prosecutor from future involvement, future administration, oversight of the case. Her name, of course, is District Attorney Fannie Willis, and also another individual in her office who was her not only a co-prosecutor there, but also someone with whom she had a romantic interest. We're going to talk more about the predicates for that. I'm going to spend a lot of time pulling apart the relevance issues that this incredible hearing of the past couple of days has presented to me, and I suspect you and many others, and addressing under Georgia law whether indeed there is any basis whatsoever for the disqualification of Fannie Willis, disqualification of her office generally, under the facts as presented, and wondering aloud what the connection between the various allegations and statements and representations about finances and many, many other irrelevant things has to do with the criminal prosecution of Donald Trump in that venue, a state criminal prosecution under the RICO statute of Georgia. What is the connection between those representations that we're hearing an awful lot about in that state court and the legitimacy of the criminal prosecution? And indeed, in the end, the fact that there is no basis whatsoever based upon the facts presented in this two-day evidentiary hearing to disqualify. We're going to talk about Georgia law, explain why it is that there is no there, explain why it is the relevance issue is all important, and that none of what you've heard over the past couple of days is relevant to issues that are properly before the court. Before we do that, again, we've got another caller on the line. We always appreciate your calls. Glad to have you with me this morning. Adrian, your comment or question about our subjects this morning.
Good morning. Now, Donald Trump has begun to talk about these court cases interfering with his campaigning. Now, I've had the opportunity to be in courtrooms during jury selection when a given member of the projected jury panel would try to tell the judge, look, I have to run my business or I have a very important job and I can't really be away from my job for this period of time. And the judge basically tells them, well, tough luck. It's a duty of citizenship and you have to do
That's
it.
Right.
Is it going to be the case that Donald Trump is going to be able to get away with saying that he can't participate in these jury proceedings or they have to be postponed until after the election because of he has to be allowed to do his campaigning instead?
Adrian, that is a terrific question. It's about process, but also about things we've heard from the judges already. And you've identified sort of the distinction here between some of the things you have seen and what may go on here as well. Again, the importance between a civil case and a criminal case is important. We have seen Donald Trump, for example, come and go in the New York case. He has come and gone in the E. Jean Carroll case. Those are all civil cases where Donald Trump is represented by counsel, doesn't have to be present. And we've seen him storm in and out of some of those proceedings. And so in civil cases, he is not obliged to be there. Indeed, he hasn't always been there. Adrian, your question underscores the significant difference in a criminal case. And indeed, that's exactly why Donald Trump's lawyers are so very upset with Juan Merchan, the trial judge in Manhattan, who has set this case, the hush money case, for March 25th. Because in a criminal case, the defendant is obliged to be there. This is a situation where not only does the defendant have a right to be there, but the accused is present for those criminal proceedings. That's what, in part, in many other ways, distinguishes a criminal case from a civil case. The attorneys, again, have argued precisely, Adrian, what you've identified here, to no effect. And all the judges, at least so far, who have addressed this particular issue, including Tanya Chutkan early on, the D.C. case, the interference with the election case, have said, I'm not going to treat you any differently than any other defendant in front of me. Yes, you're running for the presidency. Yes, I appreciate you're out there doing that. But Adrian, to your good point, she has said, and indeed Juan Merchan has also said in connection with this upcoming trial, that Donald Trump, you need to be there. And it is going to make for some very interesting times in about a month from now, as Donald Trump variously is in court and also pursuing his campaign. He is obliged to be there. And while those issues will continue, certainly be raised by the attorneys for Donald Trump, they will continue to complain about this and maintain that the impacts of his being present in court are directly impacting his campaign for the presidency. My expectation is that all these judges will say in these criminal proceedings, that is not sufficient to remove your obligation to be here for these cases. And anticipate, Adrian, that your good question will continue to be much on the focus and the attention of judges as they go forward. And that will one day also include, of course, the Georgia case. I'm going to talk more about that coming up in our next portion here on our Saturday morning broadcast.
Mississippi to our left, Granddad on the right. We're right in the middle. Eagle 1490 WLCX, the talk of La Crosse.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. Vice President Kamala Harris meeting with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky at the Munich Security Conference as he requests more U.S. aid for his country. Both have been reacting to the event's big news, the death of Russian dissident Alexei Navalny. The Vladimir Putin critic died Friday in a penal colony. Zelensky put the blame on Vladimir Putin.
Putin does not value lives of people. He does not understand and does not respect any rules. The only thing that is important for Putin is money and power.
Allies of Navalny say he was murdered. They're demanding his body be released. President Biden visited East Palestine, Ohio on Friday, and he vowed to continue the cleanup process 1 year since a train derailment and chemical spill. And a judge in New York ordered former President Trump to pay over $355 million in a civil fraud lawsuit. It found he misrepresented his wealth to get better loan terms. This is ABC News.
A new film about Giannis. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. On Monday, a new highly anticipated documentary about the Bucks' Giannis Antetokounmpo will be released.
People might say I'm one of the best players in the NBA right now, but I don't see it. I don't feel it because I'm scared of losing all this.
It's the story of how Charles and Veronica Antetokounmpo fled Nigeria to Greece to raise their four boys and the struggles they faced. Giannis's mother, Veronica.
We left Nigeria looking for a better life in Greece.
The dream of every father is to give your children a better education.
As an immigrant, you are nothing.
We've always been outsiders. We had to live in fear.
It's called Giannis, A Marvelous Journey. The film reveals how Giannis reacted to the news in 2017.
54-year-old Charles Antetokounmpo suffered a heart attack.
I said, I don't want to play no more.
Giannis, A Marvelous Journey debuts this week on Amazon Prime. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
With your forecast, I'm Corey Hartman. Quite windy today. Winds will gust over 30 miles per hour, maybe 35 out of the west. Even though we'll have sunshine and air temps near 32, wind chills will be near zero or below most of the day. For tonight, mostly clear and breezy and a low around 25.
Right now, it's 19.
Covering all the news that affects you with humor and a unique perspective. Matinaire on Air with Jane Matinaire. Weekdays 10 till noon on the Talk of La Crosse, Eagle 1490 AM WLCX, and on the Civic Media app.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show.
Jim from Racine, welcome. What do you got for us?
Hey, Jim.
I voted for Reagan back in the day. I guess I've been supporting more of the Democratic Party for the last 40 years or so, but people don't say, oh, man, she's a Republican, she's a Democrat, she's whatever. I'm a human being. All these other things aren't important. We need to unite against a bigger threat. I think the threat is us becoming a dictatorship. They want us to fail.
The Devil's Advocates Radio Show. Weekday afternoons from 4 until 6 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
It's easy to listen to your favorite local radio station anytime. Download the Civic Media app from the Apple or Google Play Store, then listen live or whenever you want from anywhere for free.
What La Crosse and Western Wisconsin is talking about, you're soaring with the Eagle. Eagle 1490 WLCX.
Thank you.
discussion now this morning on our Saturday morning broadcast of this major RICO prosecution pending in Fulton County in Georgia, alleging that Donald Trump and about 18 other people engage in various acts, a wide sweeping charge, set of charges there, involved with attempting to undermine, to affect, to influence, to distort, to steal the election in Georgia based upon the legitimate votes cast by Georgia voters. A very broad indictment there brought by Fani Willis. She is the prosecutor in the case, but returned by and charged by, important point, two grand juries. One of them an investigative grand jury under Georgia law. The second one an indicting grand jury. Very important point to understand in our federal system, certainly in many state systems as well, including there in Georgia, that the prosecutor is responsible for prosecuting the charges, the cases that are returned or issued by a grand jury. And what is a grand jury? A grand jury is a group of people, typically about 25, 26 people, who are brought together from the community. They're not prosecutors. They're not necessarily lawyers, who review evidence and determine whether there's probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And that's exactly what happened in Georgia a number of months ago. And in the wake of that review by this grand jury of the evidence in Georgia there, the grand jury returned this very broad, sweeping indictment. And in the wake of that, one of the defendants, his name is Michael Roman, he's one of the 19 charged with violations of RICO there, has brought a motion. He has brought a motion seeking to disqualify the prosecutor, Fani Willis, and yes, indeed, one of her co-prosecutors with whom Fani Willis has also had a personal relationship. His name is Nathan Wade. And Roman is seeking to have them disqualified from the prosecution of this case. And so I want to spend some time this morning pulling apart the notion that is again, it's an applicable two cases, if indeed disqualification is appropriate. But the notion under these facts that Fani Willis should be disqualified, completely unfounded, completely unsupported by what we have seen, not only in the pleadings, but especially in the hearings of the past couple of days. You know what this is all about. The allegation is that Fani Willis has brought onto the staff this fellow named Nathan Wade, and depending upon what the evidence is or does not show, the nature of the relationship, when it started, when it ended, those kinds of things, all matters of the review in the evidentiary hearing of just the past couple of days. But along the way, Mr. Roman, through his attorneys, alleging that the alleged romantic relationship between Willis and Wade, the financial compensation that Wade received as a special prosecutor, and even things like the trips, the travel between with Wade and Willis while they were together romantically, that those kinds of things have an impact upon the prosecution of him, and therefore that they should be disqualified. Indeed, the entire office should be disqualified for that personal behavior. Now, let me say at the outset that I have never, as a supervisor in a prosecution office, including my 6.5 years as U.S. attorney, I have not been an especially big supporter of these relationships inside offices. Not that people can't have personal relationships, but the relationships can indeed cause problems. And indeed, there's no doubt that the relationship here between Nathan Wade and Fani Willis, which is apparently now over, has brought attention to them personally in a way that's a diversion from the principal focus, which is the prosecution of Donald Trump. And it resulted in a two-day, a border-to-border, 8 o'clock to 5 o'clock hearing in front of Judge Scott McAfee, who's presiding over the criminal prosecution. He entertained evidentiary presentations by various witnesses, including Nathan Wade, including Fani Willis, about whether this personal relationship qualifies as a basis, a factual basis, to disqualify Fani Willis and the entire office from prosecution. A couple of things related to this. And that is, number one, fundamental notion that defendants do not have the ability, do not have the capacity, do not have the right to choose their prosecutors. And as I said, there certainly are things related to the personal relationship here, maybe in other cases as well, that need to be addressed. But those are matters for internal issues inside the district attorney's office, and they do not impact and should not impact going forward with the prosecution. Let's talk about this in particular. Under Georgia law, even if all the factual allegations that are set forth about the travel, about the payments, about the nature of the relationship, all the other, I would present, irrelevant things that have been said during the course of these hearings of the past couple of days, let's assume all of those are true. There still is no basis for Judge McAfee to disqualify the office and Fannie Willis from the further prosecution of this case. The key point is that regardless of those factual circumstances, the matters related to hiring and the timing of that, the relationship, all of that do not affect the propriety of the prosecution against Roman and his co-defendants, including Donald Trump. Questions, for example, about gifts, related matters, go to Willis's and Wade's obligations to the DA's office. And in that connection, they have no connection to assuring the defendant, in this case, Mr. Roman, presumably the others as well, a fair trial. The allegations, the things we heard about in the past couple of days, all these facts are interesting. They are related plainly to personnel, HR, human resources matters inside the office that need to be addressed. That certainly are a diversion that have gotten now the entire nation focused upon this issue and not the principal issues, which are the prosecution going forward of Donald Trump and the others. But the fundamental presentations do not have this connection to ensuring a defendant, including Mr. Roman, has a fair trial presented to him. He's got a right to that. It's not related to these particular personnel issues. There is irrelevant to the trials allegations, for example, in other situations that, for example, prosecutors took supplies for personal use, office supplies, if you will. Let's suppose they drove some county vehicles on personal errands, even did things inside the office that relate to interactions with their coworkers. All of those are legitimate issues. They're legitimate issues for the prosecutor's offices internally to deal with and things that need to be addressed by virtue of the oversight responsibilities of supervisors inside those offices. But those allegations, those kinds of things, personal matters, relationships, monetary matters that do not impact the underlying, the most important prosecution itself, they do not affect the criminal prosecutions that require them to stop or be suspended, certainly not being dismissed, and do not justify the removal of the prosecutors themselves. Let's talk about what Georgia law says and what it does not say when it comes to prosecutorial disqualification. It's actually exceptionally narrow. And there are allegations, the allegations here do not fit in any of the categories in Georgia law under which Fannie Willis could be disqualified. Again, the focus of the claims by Mr. Roman, alleged romantic relationship between Willis and Wade, some financial compensation that Wade received as a special prosecutor, and this personal travel that Willis and Wade took together, other related things along the way. Two generally recognized grounds for disqualification in the state of Georgia. The first is a conflict of interest, which we'll talk about more. And the second is forensic misconduct. What is forensic misconduct? That's doing things like going out and creating evidence that does not otherwise exist, falsifying records, suborning perjury, those kinds of things that would prompt you to say there is a real miscarriage of justice here. It would not only have you taken off the case, but probably have you disbarred, maybe even prosecuted criminally. Misconduct in terms of managing the evidence and doing things that are meant intentionally to undermine the legitimacy of the prosecution. No allegations here whatsoever of any forensic misconduct whatsoever. And so what about a conflict of interest? What about a conflict of interest? Does that exist? Well, there are such things as conflicts of interest out there. A conflict of interest, again, in Georgia law, arises when the prosecutor previously had represented the defendant, for example, with respect to an offense charged. Prosecutor might be disqualified, for example, if he is a fact witness in the case against the defendant. That couldn't happen, right? A conflict of interest could happen when the prosecutor has a relationship to a victim, maybe even a member of the grand jury. That kind of thing would be a conflict of interest. Conflict of interest leading to disqualification could exist when a prosecutor is compensated by a contingency fee that is paid only if a conviction is secured. Because that fee arrangement creates sort of at least the appearance of a conflict of interest between the public duty to seek justice and a private right to obtain compensation for those services. None of those apply in this particular case. Let's talk about those in particular and why it is that the standards under Georgia law simply do not apply, and that all the things that you heard during the course of the past 2 days are irrelevant to the legitimacy of the prosecution against Donald Trump. There is no per se rule of disqualification based upon marital status in Georgia. The Georgia Supreme Court has even explained that even married couples on opposing sides of litigation do not suffer from a conflict of interest. The opportunity, if you will, for a conflict of interest, some potential impropriety between spouses on opposing sides of litigation are greater than those on the same side of the case working toward the same outcome. And that's what you have here. You've got two people on the same side of the case, not a conflict there, but a similarity, a symmetry, if you will, of interest. There is in the end no plausible argument that non-married attorneys who are together prosecuting a case, admittedly in a romantic relationship, who serve together in this role, creates a conflict of interest for the defendant, robbing that defendant in some way of their right to a fair trial. Simply isn't there. The same applies to this issue about financial compensation that Wade may have received as a special prosecutor. Likewise, those kinds of things simply do not provide support for a finding by the judge of any problem here. The financial compensation paid to Wade is, frankly, consistent with some well-established practices in Georgia, does not give rise to a conflict of interest warranting prosecutorial disqualification. And again, publicly available documents, part of them presented during the course of this evidentiary hearing, are indicating that Wade's compensation was not contingent, of course, on the outcome of the prosecution against Roman or anybody else. Again, that is a system that it plainly would be contrary to fundamental justice movement, that somehow the prosecutor benefits financially if indeed there's a prosecution that is successful. In all of the years that I was a federal prosecutor, state prosecutors as well, you get paid by the state. And your salary comes to you whether you are successful or not. It is not contingent, not at all contingent upon the result, whether guilty or not guilty, in the criminal prosecution itself. Again, the evidence presented about the Wade prosecution, simply not relevant, not related to the legitimacy of the underlying prosecution, concerns about whether or not somehow the issues here have been muddied in such a way that America now thinks that these are indeed relevant issues. In a related point, it's also significant that Roman's motion to disqualify also complains that Wade has never tried a felony RICO case. That's a part of his motion as well. And there again, as I said before, defendants do not have the right, the prerogative to choose their prosecutors. You can make decisions about employment that are good, bad, someplace in between. Again, those are personnel matters inside the DA's office. They may be issues for resolution by supervisors and others, but they don't have that connection, that relevant connection between what was going on inside the office and the legitimacy of the prosecution outside of the office. What is missing here of all of these cases, all these instances, including this personal travel issue, which we heard a lot about, is how, in fact, that has a substantive impact, somehow denigrates the prosecution of Donald Trump and the others, including Mr. Roman, in this case going forward in Georgia. When we come back, I'm going to make a prediction about what Judge McAfee does here in connection under Georgia law, in connection with the Roman petitions, and we'll talk about that and more right after this brief break.
Listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for the Devil's Advocates radio show.
It's Black History Month, and Civic Media supports the importance of this observance. But what do you really know about it? I'm Calvin Butenhoff, producer of The Earl Ingram Show. Our Echoes of Empowerment Black History Stories will offer thoughtful answers all month long. Now, here's Earl.
You cannot talk about Black history without including some of the early music and art which flourished in the 1920s and 30s. Time now called the Harlem Renaissance. But this new Black cultural identity was growing everywhere. Trumpet player Louis Armstrong moved to Chicago. Painter Henry Tanner was accepted into the Academy of Design. Musician Robert Johnson recorded the Delta Blues in Texas. Listen for another Black History story right here on Civic Media. I'm Earl Ingram.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, LaCrosse's home for the Todd Allball Show.
The Shaw, WAUK. The Shaw, WAUK. The Shaw.
Analysis or discussion this morning of the evidentiary hearing that America was tuned into for the past couple of days, including the testimony of Fani Willis and her co-prosecutor, Nathan Wade, with whom she admitted she had a personal relationship, and asking the question, if not answering it this morning, of how this is relevant, to any prosecution of Donald Trump, which does proceed, and most specifically, under what rubric, under what structure does any of this information about the financial relationship between them, the personal relationship between them, the compensation of Mr. Wade, all of that, what is the relationship between that and a reason to disqualify the prosecutor in the prosecution itself? The answer is that there is none under Georgia law. There is nothing about the forensics of this. There's no conflict of interest. There are no two interests that are conflicting here. Instead, there is simply allegations and perhaps even proof of personal relationships inside the office. Those do not affect the legitimacy of the prosecution going forward. And those of us listening and watching, including you, to the evidentiary presentations of this past couple of days, had to be scratching our heads collectively saying, what is going on here? If the judge is, in fact, simply attempting to make a full record for Donald Trump and for Mr. Roman himself, giving them the full opportunity, as he said once, to present your case, that is one thing. If, on the other hand, the notion is that somehow there is a legitimate, there's a there's something real here, this is a legitimate argument to make, the answer is no. This is nearly frivolous in terms of its presentation. And anticipate that Judge McAfee will soon, hopefully very soon, issue an order finding that none of the evidentiary presentations, while interesting, maybe salacious, maybe appropriate for coffee table conversation about what's going on inside the office, do not in fact constitute a conflict of interest for Fani Willis or her office that in any way deprives either Mr. Roman, Mr. Trump, or any of the other defendants of a right to a jury trial, right to a prosecution that is free from interference from anything that is inappropriate or wrong. That's simply not here. And so under Georgia law, as we have described it, all these things make clear that while this process perhaps had to be conducted as a part of the pretrial proceedings, it has been, as many people have said, a sideshow, a collateral issue, a footnote to what should be the focus, which is the substance of the prosecution as it goes forward. We hasten to add once again, Donald Trump, and Mr. Roman, other people in this case who have not yet pled guilty, the presumption of innocence stays with them as it will, as all of this goes forward. Anticipate that Judge Scott McAfee hopefully will make short shrift of this, issue an order, perhaps an oral ruling, maybe a substantive written ruling about all this, but should come to a conclusion fairly soon. All of this, of course, a diversion and also taking time away from the actual work of prosecuting and defending this case pending right now in the Georgia court. Find this morning some commentary about Wisconsin itself coming right back home. We know from our previous discussions way back in December 22nd, our Supreme Court overturned the current maps that are existing for our recent elections here in the state of Wisconsin for the Assembly and the Senate, and ordered that parties propose new ones. The vote on that decision was 4-3. And in the wake of that, the court hired some academic consultants to analyze those proposals for new maps. It directed the parties on both sides to file memorandums of law, and all that has been going on. Lots of briefs and responsive briefs. All that has come to a conclusion. Along the way, the consultants found that the plans offered by some Republican lawmakers and by a conservative policy group constituted partisan gerrymandering and should not be considered. The four remaining proposals, greenlit by the consultants, were submitted by the plaintiffs, by the Office of the Governor, by Tony Evers, by some Democratic senators, and also by some mathematicians and data scientists. We've got lots of maps out there. And the Wisconsin Supreme Court, again, has taken all of this, if you will, under advisement, based upon its commitment, as it said before, that if the legislature and if the governor cannot come to an agreement on their own, as they should under the normal process, then the Wisconsin Supreme Court will take this on. And based upon all the submissions, including the maps, including the statements by the lawyers, when all of that happens, they will then issue their opinion. Well, something significant happened this past week, as you have heard in the news, as you know, right here on the newscast of Civic Media. And that is that just this past week, the legislature, led by the Republicans, passed, indeed, adopted the voting maps that were drawn by the office of the governor, Tony Evers. And Tony Evers has said, of course, that he would sign that redistricting plan. It was passed unchanged. And earlier on, there was a bit of a skirmish about whether or not the plan, an earlier submission, did in fact constitute the governor's plan, the governor's maps, or if it went in fact accomplished some changes in that. It's very clear now that just this past week that the legislature passed the governor's maps themselves. And so the question now is, will the governor now sign this while this is pending also before the Wisconsin Supreme Court? Plainly, the governor's indicated that he intends to sign it. We'll see if he does that. Anticipating that he does, it is also significant to note that even under the new maps, the maps that he may have presented, that the Republicans will still retain some majorities in both chambers, though the party's advantages would likely be similar than the absolute authority it now sort of commands, particularly in the Senate. And so the net impact of this, even with the governor's plan, may not be to shift power and responsibility inside the Senate and the Assembly, but nonetheless make the maps more fair in Wisconsin. The governor should sign that map. And I know that there is some concern among some members of the legislature, particularly on the Democratic side, about the possibility of getting an even better map from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I will say simply this, that in all the civil litigation, which this is, fundamental notion that if you can settle a case, bring it to resolution, which this would presumably for the next 7 years or so, always better to try to resolve a case outside of court, even though if everybody gives up something, the Republicans and the Democrats give up something that they would otherwise have, probably a good result if everybody walks away with a settlement with which they're somewhat a bit unhappy. Common phrase, common adage out there in the civil litigation. And so we would anticipate the governor would bring this to a conclusion, the Supreme Court then not having to decide this issue. And America would look to Wisconsin and say there's a situation where the legislature and the governor did their jobs, fair maps in place for the remaining, at least remaining 7 years of our time. Next week, as in every week, we continue to focus on these issues of courts in America, American justice, government, and the aspiration for justice in Wisconsin, in our nation. Come back again next week for that important visit.
Providing you with an eagle-eye view of what lacrosse is talking about. You're soaring with Eagle 1490. Tell a friend.
Hey, this is Dom from the Devil's Advocates. Tune in Monday, 4 to 6, Crudy's gone. Nate and I are holding down the fort. When the cat's away, the mice will play. Tune in 4 to 6.
Give the star in your life the brightest gift in the world. Name a star after them. This is Rocky Moselle with International Star Registry. For $59 and a call to 800-282-3333 or visit starregistry.com, you can name a star for birthdays, weddings, or even memorials. Over 45 years, we have named millions of stars for celebrities and individuals from around the world. The star you name will be recorded in book form in the U.S. Copyright Office. Visit starregistry.com or call 800-282-3333.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming.